Welcome back to the show, everybody. I'm Mia.
And I'm Milo. Today we've got a stack of stories that all circle the same big question. When powerful things, AI models, self-driving cars, satellites, whole platforms, get built, who actually benefits, and who gets left standing when the rules get tested?
Right, and we'll go deep on each one. The human stakes of automation, and what economists think AI does to the economy by 2030. Then, how these models get built, and how openly they're marketed, a wave of new releases from the big labs and the on-device world, Apple's big hardware week led by its first foldable infrastructure that's expanding access while getting attacked. And finally, the people, platforms, and legacies aging in public.
Let's start with the one that's hardest to argue with. iProlef Spectrum has a piece pulling together mounting data on self-driving technology, and the headline number is enormous. If the tech were widely deployed, it could prevent around 580,000 deaths per year.
That's not a rounding error. That's a public health crisis worth of lives. And the piece isn't just about fully autonomous vehicles. Some of the most striking data is about much simpler systems. Automatic emergency braking alone cuts pedestrian crashes by 27% and rear-end crashes by 50%.
And that matters because AEB is already shipping in ordinary cars. You don't need a Ropoxy future for that benefit. You need automakers to keep putting the sensors in and regulators to keep pushing adoption. The pedestrian number especially, because pedestrians are the most vulnerable people on the road, and a 27% reduction there is a lot of people walking home instead of going to the hospital.
The rear-end figure is interesting too, because rear-end crashes are often about reaction time, and a machine's reaction time is consistently better than a distracted human's. So the low-hanging fruit isn't the sci-fi scenario, it's the boring assist features.
But then the 580,000 deaths number, that's the full autonomy scenario. And that's where the debate gets sharper. Because to get that kind of reduction, you need the tech to actually work at scale, in weather, in weird edge cases, and you need people to trust it enough to let it drive.
Which is the unresolved question here, honestly. The data says the ceiling is incredibly high. What's still unknown is how fast we get there, and whether the edge cases, the ones that make headlines when a self-driving system fails, slow adoption down. The aggregate numbers say the tech saves lives. Individual failures dominate the news cycle. That tension isn't going away.
Okay, so that's the physical world stakes. There's a companion piece to this in a way. Anthropic's economics team put out a model of what AI does to the US economy by 2030, and they don't give one answer. They give three scenarios.
And the spread between those scenarios is the whole story. The modest scenario is internet-like, transformative over decades, disruptive, but something society has absorbed before. Then there's a substantial scenario, bigger than that, and then an extreme scenario, which they describe as genuinely unprecedented in economic history, and which is driven by self-improving AI, the model accelerating its own development.
The internet-like comparison is doing a lot of work there. The internet reshaped retail, media, work, but it took 20-some years, and economists could study it as it happened. The extreme scenario breaks that template because there's no precedent. That's why unprecedented is a scary word coming from economists who usually love precedents.
And notice how these two stories sit next to each other. On the driving side, we have concrete measured outcomes. Crashes cut by specific percentages. On the AI side, we have scenario modeling. Because we simply don't have the equivalent data yet.
The big unknown, and Anthropic themselves frame it this way, is which scenario actually lands. If it's the modest one, the 2030 conversation looks like the 2010 seconds internet conversation. If it's the extreme one, nothing in the economic playbook applies.
And those scenarios are a good frame for everything else we're covering today. Because every model release, every pricing move, every acquisition, is evidence for one scenario or another. So let's get into the models themselves, because there's a trio of stories here about how these systems are built, borrowed, and sold.
The first one is a clever test. Someone ran what's called a reasoning prefill experiment on Qwen 3.8. They prefilled the model's context with its own reasoning, and the model's answers shifted by over 18 percentage points toward the answers GPT-5.5 Pro gives.
18 points is a big shift. The interpretation people are running with is distillation, that Qwen 3.8 may have been trained on outputs from GPT-5.5 Pro, and pre-filling its reasoning somehow activates those borrowed patterns. The idea is that if a model has internalized another model's reasoning style, prompting it along those lines makes the inheritance visible.
It's worth being careful. A shift in answers under one experimental condition is a hint, not a conviction. But it's a hint that matters, because distillation is the quiet engine of the whole frontier imitation economy. If a lab can get 90% of a frontier model's behavior by training on its outputs, the moat around the frontier gets much thinner.
And then the frontier labs would say that's exactly why they lock things down. Which brings us to OpenAI and the Navier-Stokes claim. They announced an AI math breakthrough on Navier-Stokes, one of the Clay Millennium problems, and it immediately ignited controversy on two fronts: allegations that the approach copied researchers' work, and criticism of the secrecy pressure around the whole thing.
This is a story about provenance and marketing at the same time. If you announce a Millennium problem solve, you're claiming the highest stakes prize in the field. So when researchers come forward saying the approach looks like theirs, the question isn't just academic credit. It's whether the claim itself was oversold, and whether the secrecy that frontier labs operate under made proper engagement with the community impossible.
And you can see the pattern with the Qwen test. In both cases, the substance of the model is less contested than where its abilities came from and who gets to know about it.
There's a third piece here that fits the same theme. Sebastian Raschka, weighing in on GPT-6 Astra's looped transformers, the recurrent depth architecture. His argument is that looping is mostly just reusing the same weights to stack layers. It's a clever efficiency move. You get more effective depth without more parameters, but it doesn't inherently hive the chain of thought.
That last point is pointed, because there was an implicit pitch around recurrent architectures that they might give you latent reasoning, thinking that happens inside the model's forward pass where you can't read it. Raschka is deflating that. If looping is weight reuse, then it's an engineering optimization, not a privacy feature for the model's thoughts.
So across all three stories, where did the capability come from? Was it borrowed? Is it being honestly marketed? And there's an odd symmetry. An open weights lab accused of borrowing from a closed one, and a closed lab accused of borrowing from researchers while hiding the work.
Openness cuts both ways. And that's a good bridge to the release cycle itself, because this stretch had a genuinely crowded field of new models, from the cloud down to your phone.
Let's start in the cloud. DeepSeek is set to release V4.1 Flash, targeting around September 10, 2026, and the claim is that it surpasses V4 Pro on all key metrics. That's notable in itself, the Flash variant beating the flagship. But the pricing is the real headline. Off-peak, $0.15 per million input tokens and $0.60 per million outputs.
That's astonishingly cheap. And off-peak pricing is the mechanism worth pausing on. It means DeepSeek is treating compute like an airline treats seats. If you can run your batch jobs at 3 a.m., you pay a fraction. That turns idle capacity into a product.
And it ratchets pressure on everyone else, because when a frontier competitive model costs pennies, AI is expensive, stops being a moat. For researchers and hobbyists, It also means experiments that were cost prohibitive last cycle are now trivial to run.
Meanwhile, OpenAI is pushing capability in a very different direction. Physical world direction, actually. GPT-5.6 Sol plus Codex autonomously calibrated a 6-qubit chip at MIT. And I want to flag the failure mode here because it's the most honest part of the story. It succeeded at the calibration, but failed on the noisy signals.
That's the pattern you want to see in agentic AI demos, actually. A clean statement of what it did and where it fell over. Calibrating quantum hardware is exactly the kind of tedious, precision-heavy task that models should be good at. Tight feedback loops. Well-defined objective. Noisy signals are where the environment stops cooperating with you. And that's a genuinely different problem.
It's also a real lab task, not a benchmark. A model touching physical lab equipment at a university is a different category from a model answering exam questions.
And then, at the opposite end of the size spectrum, Desert and Labs shipped 18 free on-device models covering audio, vision, and text, all running locally.
And the companion piece, the app Vaws, is the demo of why that matters. It transcribes 10 minutes of audio in 2 seconds on an iPhone. That's roughly 300 times real time on the phone, not in a data center.
300 times real time locally would have sounded like a vendor fantasy a few years ago. And it connects directly to the DeepSeek story. Capability and pricing pressure is spreading from the cloud to the edge. If 18 free models run on your phone, the marginal cost of AI for a lot of tasks goes to zero, and the question, should I send this to the cloud, gets asked more skeptically for cost, latency, and privacy reasons.
The unresolved question there is quality at the edge. Small models are fast and free, but the frontier is still the frontier. Though the gap keeps narrowing, and the DeepSeek pricing story means even the frontier is getting cheap.
Okay, from models to metal. Apple had a big hardware wave, and the centerpiece is their first foldable, the iPhone Duo.
And the specs they led with, the largest iPhone display ever, 50% larger than the 18 Pro Max, a titanium frame, the A20 Pro chip, and, this is the detail people noticed, eSIM only, no SIM slot at all.
The no SIM slot decision is a form factor bet in itself. Removing the tray frees internal space in a device where every millimeter of hinge engineering is contested. But it also hard commits Apple to the eSIM future in markets where physical SIM is still the norm, which will be a friction point for travelers and in regions where carriers are slower on eSIM support.
The foldable joins the rest of the lineup. iPhone 18 Pro and Pro Max debut a 48MP Fusion main camera with variable aperture. The A20 Pro chip, a vapor chamber for thermals, and this one is historically significant, Apple's first in-house cellular modem, the C2.
The modem is the quiet, decade-long story finally resolving. Apple has been working toward replacing the external modem supplier for years, and putting the C2 in the flagship iPhone means they've decided it's ready for the product where radio quality complaints are loudest. And pairing it with the vapor chamber makes sense. In-house silicon, plus better cooling, is the whole performance story in one device.
Variable aperture on the camera is the other interesting engineering choice. It's an optical mechanism moving parts in the camera module, which Apple historically avoided. It suggests they're prioritizing photographic control, depth, and light management over sealing everything solid.
Then the wearables. Watch Series 12 claims the most accurate heart rate sensing in a wearable, with higher frequency heart rate and HRV sampling. And the reaction on Hiker News was pointed. The battery is still 24 hours.
That criticism has teeth because it's been the same number for years. The argument from the critics is essentially, sensor fidelity is improving, the display and chip are improving, but the fundamental constraint on how you use the watch, charge it every night, hasn't moved. If you're claiming medical-grade sensing, continuous multi-day monitoring becomes the obvious ask, and a 24-hour battery makes that hard.
Though the counterargument writes itself too. Higher frequency sampling drains more battery, so holding the same runtime while increasing sensing frequency is arguably its own achievement. The disagreement is really about what the watch is for. A daily device you charge nightly, or a health monitor that should never blink.
And rounding out the wave, AirPods 5 bring two features that were Pro only down to the standard line. Open ear active noise cancellation, with 50% more noise removed than AirPods 4, and the stem volume swipe.
Open ear ANC sounds like a contradiction. Earbuds that don't seal doing noise cancellation? But it's the form factor a lot of people actually want. And cutting noise by half more than the previous generation without a seal is real engineering. Putting it and the volume swipe on non-Pro models is Apple flattening its feature ladder, which users love and which quietly reduces the reason to buy up.
The through ride for the whole Apple section is in-house silicon and form factor bets. Modem, foldable, optical mechanics. Those are the decisions that define the next 10 years, not the spec sheet increments. And hardware like this, whatever you think of it, runs on infrastructure. Which brings us to a section where infrastructure is both expanding what's possible and coming under fire.
Let's start with the expansion. GNU Radio World has a companion-style flow graph editor that runs entirely in the browser via WebAssembly, with support for RTL SDR dongles over Web USB. No install.
This is a bigger deal than it sounds. GAU Radio is the standard toolkit for software-defined radio, but it's notoriously punishing to set up. Dependencies, tool chains, versions. Moving the Flowgraph editor to the browser removes the entire on-ramp problem. A student with a $30 RTL SDR dongle and a Chromebook can build a radio receiver in a tab.
Web USB is the enabling trick. The browser talking directly to the radio hardware. That's a capability that used to require native applications, and it signals where browser-based tools are heading. Not just documents and games, but instruments.
Contrast that with Planet Labs, which is the industrial version of Earth observation. 97 satellites imaging all of the planet's landmass every single day. Daily, global, systematic. That's an extraordinary data set. But the Hacker News discussion zeroed in on access. Around $30,000 a year buys you imagery for only about 5% of a coastline you might want to monitor. And the point commenters made is that this pricing blocks nonprofits. The exact organizations most likely to monitor coastlines for erosion, illegal dumping, environmental change.
That's the tension in the story. The capability, daily global imaging, is genuinely revolutionary, and it's the same class of capability that only intelligence agencies had 2 decades ago. But revolutionary capability locked behind enterprise pricing serves the people who can pay, not the people with the mission. You have a browser-based radio revolution on one end, democratizing everything, and a satellite constellation on the other where the data exists but doesn't flow to the people who'd act on it.
And then the third story in this section is what happens when open infrastructure becomes a target. Read the docs, the service that hosts documentation for huge swaths of the open source world, suffered the largest DDoS attack it's ever seen. 5.5 million requests per minute, which is roughly 100 times baseline, sustained for about 10 days.
10 days is the part that stands out. An hour-long attack is an incident. 10 days is a siege. And the attackers were sophisticated, globally distributed, randomizing TLS fingerprints and headers to look like many different clients, and using cache evasion so the requests would actually hit the back end instead of bouncing off the cache.
Cache evasion is the mean detail. Most DDoS defense is serve the flood from cache. If your attacker specifically crafts requests that miss the cache, your normal defenses are designed against the wrong attack. For a free service that the open source ecosystem depends on, 10 days of that is a serious operational and financial strain.
So put the three together. GOU Radio lowering the barrier, Planet Labs raising it with pricing. Read the docs being punished for being load-bearing and open. The pattern is that infrastructure nobody charges enough for is infrastructure somebody will eventually attack or underfund.
Which is a natural ramp into our last section, because it's full of people and platforms reckoning with exactly that. What happens to the things we built as they age, and to the people who built them?
Let's start with the person, because it's the heaviest news. Lee Holloway, co-founder and CTO of Cloudflare, has stepped down. The reason is frontotemporal dementia.
And his contribution to Cloudflare is hard to overstate. He was behind the Anycast architecture, the approach of serving from many locations with one address, which is the backbone of how Cloudflare absorbs traffic and attacks at global scale, plus the core tech of the company. And before Cloudflare, he built Project Honeypot, the spam trap network that was the seed the company grew from.
There's a bitter irony there. The person whose architecture defends a huge portion of the web from attacks is stepping away because of a degenerative illness. FTD in particular affects the parts of cognition that engineering depends on. It's a reminder that behind the infrastructure stories are individuals, and their time at the top isn't guaranteed.
From one piece of foundational internet history to another, Lotus Notes, launched in 1989, had encryption, rich text, and database replication before industry standards for any of those existed.
And the longevity is the story. It ran as an ERP-style application platform well into the 2020s, still alive today as HCL Notes. Nearly every Notes discussion produces the same split verdict. People who used it as end users often recall it with horror, while people who built on it describe a platform that was a decade ahead of its time. Email, apps, security, and replication in one package when competitors were selling single features.
Ahead of its time is doing double duty there. The platform was so far ahead that the world caught up feature by feature, and by the time the ideas were standard, Notes' distinctive whole was less valuable than the parts everyone else had.
Modern platforms are navigating the same line between open and closed, and the freshest example, Shopify has acquired Tailwind Labs. Tailwind CSS itself stays MIT and open source, that's confirmed. But the commercial products, Tailwind Plus and the UI site, are closing to new customers.
And the reason given is one of the most consequential data points in the whole episode. AI has cut traffic to the Tailwind documentation by roughly 40%.
Stick with that number, because it's the business model of open source breaking in real time. The docs were the funnel. Developers hit a problem, searched, landed on Tailwind docs, saw the commercial components, bought them. If AI answers the question before the developer ever visits the site, the funnel evaporates even though the library itself is more popular than ever.
So Shopify is essentially absorbing the maintainers, the framework stays free, and the question left open is, what happens to every other open source project whose sustainability depended on being the place people visited? If AI intermediates all technical knowledge, who pays the maintainers?
There's a darker version of platform friction in another story. A developer with a Rust terminal multiplexer called Race got his Google Ads account suspended for malicious software, despite clean malware scans, and repeated appeals were rejected with no explanation.
No explanation is the operative phrase. A developer trying to promote an open source tool, flagged by an automated system, appeals rejected over and over. No human ever explains why. It's the individual version of the infrastructure vulnerability theme. When the platform's automated systems decide you're a problem, there's no process, just silence.
And when appeals go nowhere, the lesson other developers absorb is to avoid advertising entirely, which further concentrates who can reach an audience.
On a lighter note, the AI culture has produced its own satire. opusaffide.dev, an interactive site mocking Claude's agentic coding for overreaching on trivial requests, the canonical example being you ask it to make the add to cart button blue, and it reorganizes your whole code base.
So Louder lands because it's recognizable. Agentic coding tools are built and tuned to take initiative, so the failure mode is initiative applied where nobody wanted it. The site is basically the community's collective eye roll turned into a product, and it doubles as user feedback. The joke is a feature request.
There's also a more reflective take circulating. Gorn's essay, On Really Trying, which digs into the real limits of motivation, using the example of scientists accepting that their work will take 30 years rather than acting quickly.
That's a counterintuitive frame. We usually treat motivation as abundant and effort as the bottleneck. Gorn's argument inverts it. The truly limited resource is sustained will over decades, and the scientists worth admiring are the ones who commit to 30-year horizons instead of optimizing for fast, visible wins. It's an interesting counterweight to the whole AI acceleration conversation we've had today, which is all about speed.
And then the anniversary story, No Man's Sky, update 7.0. Cosmos, marking 10 years since launch. It adds space station directing, galactic alliances, orbital bases, and derelict hulk salvage.
No Man's Sky is the redemption arc of gaming. Famously overpromised at launch, and then years of free updates rebuilding trust until it's genuinely beloved. 10 years in, shipping a content update of this size is the games industry version of Gorn's 30-year scientists, sustained effort over a long horizon instead of a quick pivot.
And we end on a legal footnote that's almost poetic. In the case of X against Project Bluebird, the court found that the tweet mark and the bird logo are probably abandoned, but X gets to keep the Twitter mark via the formerly known as usage.
The company that renamed itself X dismantled the bird branding and told everyone to stop saying tweet, argued into a position where its own conduct suggests it abandoned those marks. And the one it keeps, Twitter, survives only because the site still says formerly known as Twitter. The trademark case is essentially the rebrand, litigated.
Which is a fitting final note for a section about legacies. You can change your name, but the law and the culture keep receipts.
That's the episode. From 580,000 lives to a dead bird logo, the thread running through everything was who builds the future, who pays for it, and who it actually serves.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back with the next round.